Going back to your position at Duluth, I understand there was two bases that were controlled out of that.
Yes, we had committed air defense squadrons at Duluth and also at Selfridge. Perhaps of interest at that particular time was that we also had the Army Air Defense Command, RADCOM, were still there, and they had missiles. For
the Nike
missiles. And at that time, the commander of 23rd NORAD region was General Thomas Barfield, who was an Army, a RADCOM commander. And he was the last one of the RADCOM commanders, as far as I know, in the United States. And he did retire out of Duluth in 1976.
And he was the commander of 23 NORAD?
He was the commander of 23 NORAD, a very unique position for an Army general.
Yes. And how did you, what was your position in terms of the, who did you report to in Duluth?
Well, I was an assistant to the deputy for the operations, and the DO was a colonel rank, and he reported to the brigadier general, who was in charge of the operational side, below the commander. So he was, the DO was two levels removed from the commander.
And was there a Canadian officer serving in the deputy commander's position?
Yes, we had a deputy there. He was a brigadier, Brigadier Johnson.
Well, Johnson?
Yes.
What was his first name? Do you remember?
It was ABC Johnson.
Okay.
Was as distinct from the other General Johnson that was JRF Johnson. He was in NATO, but this was ABC Johnson.
Ah, okay. Well, maybe we could go back to the process of detection and interception at that time, when you're in, during the 1973-76 period.
Uh-huh. Well, the suite of radar sites flowing from the distant early warning radar system, they would pick up any of the tracks that came through, and they would send that information to Cheyenne Mountain, to the NORAD headquarters, as the initial indication of penetration and attack. Then there was the Mid-Canada line, which was another radar set that filled up the mid area of Canada with radar.
55 degrees, I think, latitude.
Oh, yes, it would be around that.
Was it a broad band of fence? Was it a broad fence, or was it just the fence?
If an aircraft came through at a higher level, the fan of their coverage was, I believe, around 200 nautical miles for each of the sites there. But coming below then from the Mid-Canada line, we had the Canadian, the Pine Tree line, the Caden Pine Tree line. So you had this contiguous set of radar that was used for tracking. And that information was then accepted and relayed into the SAGE system, into the computers at the region. So we showed you the tracks.
Would that be coming from Colorado Springs back to the region?
No, the region would get that as a direct link from its own sites. Okay. Although warning and assessment function was primarily at the at NORAD in Colorado Springs. But we would have in the operations room at 23rd NORAD region, we would see the tracks, and then it would be the responsibility of the command element at 23rd NORAD region to be assessing those, sending up the fighter aircraft to do the intercepts in conjunction with the information that came from the SAGE system. And certain of the aircraft at that time in the SAGE system could be actually linked directly to complete the intercept without the pilot in the cockpit actually taking over the aircraft. So there was a data link that went from the SAGE system to the aircraft that would enable them, under certain circumstances, to complete the intercept.
And without the SAGE controlling the intercept, how far, what would be the range of the aircraft to target?
Oh, well, if they weren't data linked to the SAGE system, then the aircraft would be given voice vectors from the ground. and told to steer a particular heading, and it would be given the heading and range of the enemy aircraft.
So this is going back to the older manual control.
And that would be a voice control from the ground to tell him where his target was and what the range of the target was. Then the pilot would fly that particular profile until he was able to make the acquisition on his own internal weapon system guidance capability.
And this would be like a 101 Voodoo?
Yes, 101 Voodoo was capable of the data link function, yes.
And this aircraft was based in Duluth as well?
Yes. Yeah.
Were there F-106s based in Duluth at that time?
Not to my recollection. The 106s were certainly available in the adjacent section in the 24th NORAD region. I recall that quite vividly.
Going back to the 106, in terms of its capability, was it considered a long range aircraft or a short range aircraft? I'm thinking in comparison to the Voodoo.
I believe that the range was very similar.
Very similar.
In all of those, for the kind of mission we had, you would have to consider those aircraft as short range. Hard to define long range or short range, but
yes,
they're certainly shortish range.
Yes.
Although that was not necessarily a problem, because if you were tracking the Russian Bear aircraft, and they were going to be dropping gravity bombs, then, of course, you could allow them to penetrate the Canadian airspace before making an intercept.
Yeah.
That, of course, would change much later on with the introduction of submarine-launched cruise missiles and the air-launched cruise missiles that would be fired from much further out. So the defense posture would have to later dramatically change from what we had at Duluth in the 23rd to the next phase with the changing threat.
Yes, very good. So the 106 and the Voodoo were both SAGE controlled aircraft.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Now going to your next assignment, your next assignment with NORAD.
Yeah.
Was as deputy for operations at the Canadian NORAD region, mm-hmm. 1982 to 1985. Now, we briefly talked about the map of NORAD regions that I brought with me that was based on a 1983 handbook. Perhaps you could explain some of the changes that occurred during your service there.
Yes. Well, when I came from NATO headquarters in Belgium, that would be 1984. Or late 82. There had been a structural change in the NORAD organization. Canada had taken over its responsibility for all of the Canadian territory and airspace under the Canadian NORAD region at that time. The old designation of the 22nd NORAD region was gone. So we were in a transformation process then, and it was a part of, the modernization effort, again by changing threat. So the Canadian NORAD region was divided essentially into two sides of Canada East and Canada West, simply because of the size and the geography. So that was the...
So they based out of Comox in the west?
No. All of it was run out of North Bay in Ontario. We had both the Region Operations Centre, the ROC, for Canada East and Canada West in the complex at North Bay.
And this is a SAGE system operating out of there at that time?
We were essentially transforming out of SAGE at that time.
Okay.
The very large computer systems that used to be called Bonnie and Clyde at North Bay were in rooms about 200 feet long, 30 feet wide, and were vacuum tubes. And those tubes, at that time, the only replacements that I understood we could get was from Czechoslovakia, which was a kind of a very strange situation. And those get swapped out at this time. And the new computers for the processing of the information were the size of three household fridges. So there was a dramatic change in that computer capability in the changeover.
Right.
Not only the changeover of our responsibilities for command and control being now for Canada, within the two rocks, but also all of the upgrading of the computer system, and by this time the Mid-Canada line had gone.
Okay.
So there was only the distant early warning line there, the Dew line, and the Caden Pine Tree line. So there's a big gap in the center, which meant that there was not any continuity of or possibility of continuity of tracking after a breach of the Dew line. Then, of course, any penetrating aircraft would be in Never Never Land until it was captured again by radar if it penetrated the Caden Pine Tree line. So there was new concepts of operation being formed, new equipment being obtained, and a very dramatic and quite dynamic change in command and control.
Yes, could you go into more detail on that? Let's talk about equipment first. Was that a change in aircraft?
Yes. We also were retiring the 101s during this particular period of time, and the F-18 was being brought into service. And in fact, we ran, while I was there, the last bear hunt, the bear aircraft with a 101, when they were patrolling above the Dew line in the high Arctic, and we intercepted that.
You intercepted a bear?
Oh, yes. We did that on a regular basis.
Over the Canadian archipelago or over the sea?
Well, above and beyond the level of the distant early warning
interesting.
Control.
And that was during those years?
That was in this transition time, because
yes.
Commissioned the first, or declared the first F-18 squadron combat ready while I was the DO at North Bay. And so that would be somewhere, I believe that would be 1985. We had now completed that transformation from 101s to F-18s.
Oh, yes. And the F-18 was much more capable aircraft.
Oh, yeah.
Forward operation.
Yes, indeed, yes.
And is that one of the changes that was going on, the idea of operating in a more forward way?
Well, but we're in transition now because
yes.
of the changing threat.
Yes.
With the air-launched cruise missile, for example, they had a standoff range of somewhere around 1,500 kilometers that
yes.
they could launch. So, therefore, we didn't have any capability to finitely engage a cruise missile because of its low radar cross-section and because of the weapons that we had at that time would make it very difficult. So the first option then, of course, would be to try and make contact, intercept, and kill the carrier, which would be the bear at that time and or... As they were bringing in the new supersonic aircraft, the Blackjack, into the Russian inventory. So, with the loss of the Mid-Canada line, we would now have the potential of a penetration of the Dew line. Then we would not know where the attacking aircraft would be. And with the standoff capability, we had to then try and extend the range of our fighter aircraft to go further out and and engage an enemy before it was in a position to launch an air launch cruise missile.
And at the same time, the submarine threat is changing at the same time as well.
Absolutely, the submarine threat was off, and with there was always the submarine threat for ballistic missile, and that was a great problem for NORAD with its straight missile, because the warning time from launch off either coast of a missile from a submarine would be only in the vicinity of 10, no more than 15 minutes, for example. Whereas an ICBM launch, you were looking at the flight time and the potential warning of one coming in the vicinity of 30-odd minutes, so there was a very short time frame.
Right.
Now, when we changed, or when the threat was changing to the submarine launch cruise missile, now it had the same impact that we low radar cross section, coming in low. We didn't have good coastal radars or with the significant amount of discrimination to pick those up, and also they posed a great threat to attempting to have an aircraft kill a cruise missile.
Yes.
So that was a weapon system difficulty and problem that was being addressed. In addition, though, with the ALCM and the modernization that was going on, with the computer systems being modernized, the new upgraded aircraft, the AWACS aircraft,
yes,
were now to play a very large part of the game.
So the computer, the revisions to the computer systems, this was being done by the by American companies for this Canadian change, or were Canadians involved in that process?
Well, yes, Canadians were certainly involved in the program, both in the technical aspect of requirements, and also we were in the funding profile as well. So it was a joint effort.
Joint. And was it given a new name, as opposed to SAGE? Was it?
Well, we actually dropped the name SAGE.
Dropped the name.
Because the SAGE system per se was now gone.
Okay.
Now, at the same time, though, as we were the Americans had changed their aircraft also from the F-102 and the F-106 and the old Phantoms. They were now up into the F-15.
Yes, very capable aircraft.
Very capable. And similarly, we with the F-18. Another problem that came, though, they were to be married or mated with the aspect of in control and in conjunction with the AWACS aircraft, the E-3As.
Yes.
That was part of the concept, that they would go out and be like a hunter-killer pack, looking for any enemy that had penetrated the new North Warning system that was being brought into being. It wasn't the Dew-Line system,
yes,
though. It was the North Warning system that was being introduced.
And I believe the North Warning system had a broader fence. It was 350 kilometers or something like that.
It was perhaps a little larger, but the problem there was not necessarily the breadth of it. There was going to be main sites in the North Warning system. Then there would be gap filler radars.
Yeah.
But the threat had changed with the cruise missile and the standoff capability. The bombers could now transit that area at low level, not at high level.
Oh, yes.
So therefore, your radar coverage band was not 300 miles above sea level.
Yes.
At very high level, which they would have to do before with a standard bomb, they would have to transit at high level because of the range of the aircraft, so they could get home.
Oh yeah.
So now the
AWACS
yes,
became very important to the operation of these fighters.
Absolutely. Oh, yes. And to extend the range. It meant we're now into trying to extend or to get new and different resources in the competition for funding and budgetary money, and we can maybe touch on that later. But what would happen there is, for those aircraft to go out, the F-15 and the F-18, there was a requirement for aerial refueling now.
Yes.
So we had to get some tanker aircraft, and they had to now be available. So as you can see, that
the tankers were not a component of the earlier fighter systems.
No, they're not, certainly not in Canada, and certainly not in anything that we had in our inventory for refueling.
Yes. Yes.
So that brought a new dimension as to the requirements in this very dramatic changing time because of the changing threat, the obsolescence of the old system. It was getting a bit tired.
Yes.
So, and then the competition for money and the change of command and control structure, and we'll probably get to that a little later, because
yes,
the command and control structure a couple of years after this in 85-86 dramatically shifts with the change in NORAD and the headquarters, the Star Wars, the Reagan initiatives, the formation of the United States U.S. Space Command, the Air Force Space Command, and all of that transformation, and etc. But that's
so big
the next chapter.
Big changes.
Yes.
Now going back to the aircraft, the F-15 and the CF-18,
yeah,
they were equipped with more sophisticated radars than the previous generation of fighters as well.
Oh yes, yes. And I don't have any particular details of that, of those systems, because I never did fly that aircraft, but they were certainly much more capable, much more.
But rather than ground control of the intercept, the intercept would be controlled by the radar operators in the AWACS plane.
Oh yes, oh absolutely. That was one of the dramatic changes and transformation, because which drove a whole bunch of new communications requirements between the fighter aircraft and the AWACS aircraft, and also between the AWACS and the ground control, and of course during very shortly thereafter, the Caden Pine Tree line was gone. So now we're into new communications requirements, new communication suites, and new concepts of operation. And
communication seems to be such an important part of it.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about that.
Because what's happening in the air needs to be relayed back to headquarters.
That's correct, yes.
Because if it is an actual attack, then that information has to get back to the president.
Yes.
And the prime minister.
That's right, yes.
So much of NORAD's responsibility was detection.
NORAD's responsibility was attack warning and threat assessment, and the NORAD headquarters was responsible for passing that information to the other component commanders, as they called them in the United States, pass the information to SAC at Omaha, and in addition to any of the other continental commands that required the information.
Yes, this brings us to your assignment as Director of Air Defense at Colorado Springs itself, from 1985 to 1989.
Yes.
Now you're at North American Aerospace Defense Command.
That, yes.
Which I believe was a name change that occurred in 81, thereabouts.
Yes.
Is that because of the monitoring, like, space? Is the NORAD monitoring air traffic in space at that time?
Yeah. I think it might have been a little bit later than 1981, but that's neither here nor there.
Yes.
When I first went to NORAD in Colorado Springs, the title was Director of Air Defense, and we were
yes.
in the Chidlaw building downtown in Colorado Springs. We're there for about a year or so.
In the town itself.
Yes, in this building, and it was the command center. Then.
Any of your responsibilities there?
Well, that was still purely in the air defense traditional sense that that we had seen before. The transition came shortly thereafter into some of the more esoteric space involvement, at least for my position.
Yes.
And the headquarters moved from downtown out to Peterson Air Force Base.
Okay.
So we had the new headquarters of NORAD, the static headquarters, not the Cheyenne Mountain complex itself in the mountain, but the, could probably call it the administrative end of NORAD.
So you worked out of Peterson at that time?
We went to Peterson Air Force Base.
Yeah.
Then, of course, at Peterson Air Force Base, there was the Air Force Space Command. And then following that was the creation of the United States Space Command. So we can talk perhaps about the command control relationships a little bit more. But at that time, we were now into out of the role of my department in the planning became so much greater and so much wider at that because of the movement or the issues surrounding Reagan's Space Defense Initiative, the SDI. We also had the air defense initiatives. We had the SDA 2000, which was a defense architecture, strategic defense architecture 2000. So all of these things were addressing the new threat. And the requirement for new and better ways to get the information, the warning information, we were fairly robust still in the missile warning field with the ballistic missile warning systems at Thule and Fylingdales in England, the BMUs.
Yes.
That was fairly robust for that missile warning. But the threat now from low-level ALCM, etc., and it caused a total change in the philosophy, if you will, of NORAD.
Because now you were no longer thinking of bombers coming in to drop a payload on top of a
Correct.
City.
Correct.
No, it was a long-distance attack.
That's right.
Yes.
So how do you counteract that particular thing? We had the components of the new system was we had a north warning system, a barrier in the north, no mid-Canada line, Pine Tree line was gone, coastal radars were in a sense no longer of much use against a cruise missile. So we were into the area of total reconfiguration. What
you mentioned barrier in the north.
Yes. The north warning system was essentially a tripwire barrier, a warning.
Okay.
Now, over the horizon backscatter radar was the new systems that were under test, under trial, and hopefully to be brought in, and they would be placed where they would look out over the east and the west side, out to about 1,500 miles, and they would be able to give warning information of anything that was ingressing.
So low-level attack is covered in by that system.
That was correct. So,
whereas the older systems were vulnerable to that.
Yes. The radars. So that was another part of the matrix was to, at least in the planning, was to get. So what did we need to make in the planning function this new system work? Well, we had the North Warning System. There were space initiatives going on in various ways.
Regarding satellites,
and the command and control structures were being changed. And we needed forward operating locations for the fighters, so we needed to move them forward as a result of threat information, intelligence.
Yes.
They would have to move much further up. They couldn't sit back at Cold Lake or whatever, because with the North tripwire, if a bomber did come through, then it would be lost. There would be no radar on it.
Yes.
So unless your fighters were forward placed, they would have a free transit, then nobody would be able to track them inside, and so there would be no through. There would be great difficulty, if not impossible, of tracking them coming after they came through the North Warning System.
Yes, yes. So in order to prepare these forward positions,
right,
that involved the preparation of airfields and things?
Yes. Well, this was the new thing, or new planning, as to who would go there, when they would go there, how they would go there, infrastructure. F-18s would potentially go to forward operating locations. In due course, also potentially F-15s would go to northern locations. requirements were established for a dozen AWACS aircraft to be forward placed.
And all the AWACS aircraft were American.
Absolutely, yes. Although Canada did have a commitment to provide two crews, and they were we participated in AWACS at Tinker Air Force Base, and also we had crews on board AWACS in Alaska.
Oh yes.
At that.
So those two crews would be out of how many crews altogether?
Oh, I really don't know. I couldn't say. The whole fleet of AWACS, I don't know the numbers.
Okay.
But there was an established NORAD requirement
for
12 AWACS.
Yes, okay.
So during this whole period of time, we were doing words like, we needed NORAD statements of operational requirements. You had to do this for planning, for future air defense operations, for forward operating locations, for wide area surveillance systems, for beyond line of sight communications. So we're in the process of trying to put this whole thing together for application for monies and the budgeting cycle, etc. To my knowledge, the over the horizon backscatter radars were never fielded.
Yes.
So that has died on the vine. So we were very susceptible on the east and west coast. The coastal radars that were there before, they were declared not necessary, and they would be looked at later to see whether they had any usefulness for NATO.
Yes.
Also in the north, there was interesting continuity work that we were doing to join our northern radar, the North Warning System, and integrate it across the top into the Greenland radars.
Okay.
Because they were not NORAD, and transfer information between those two systems and get information from Greenland back. So we're doing all of this planning and trying to put the plan together. So it was extremely dynamic. And at the same time, reorganizing, because of United States Space Command, missile warning, and some of the responsibilities NORAD had before in that area were removed and taken. So there was some friction between
yes.
The commands there.
Yes.
And Interesting enough, the general, at the first school, General Harries was there, and he was... General Harries, yes, the American Saint NORAD. He was the Commander-in-Chief NORAD.
Yes.
He was also made the Commander-in-Chief of United States Space Command.
Yes.
And he was also the Commander-in-Chief of United States United States Space Command. He was three-hatted.
Yes.
Which was a very dramatic thing.
Who was the deputy commander under him at that?
In NORAD,
yes.
It was General McNaughton at that time. And before him was General McKenzie. In this transformation.
Yes.
And in United States Space Command, the deputy there was a Navy admiral. And the ground rules became that the United States Space Command the SYNC could be named on a best qualified basis between United States Air Force, Navy, and/or Army.
Okay.
So that was an interesting wrinkle. So
yes. Now the Canadians weren't involved in those the Space Command.
No. We're not involved in that, but obliquely,
yes.
Because politically, with the space defense initiatives, Canada had kind of begged off joining into those areas, although we did have some input.
Technical contribution?
Yes.
Yes.
And that was another ballgame because the public and the political side of it didn't want us to really be involved in missile or ballistic missile defense, for example, and space-based and arms length. So there was a lot of political maneuvering going on at that time and staying somewhat at arm's length.
But unofficially, we keep our foot in the door.
Yes, and it created some difficulties in my department. Because of the air defense initiatives and the surveillance systems that were there and the information that we wanted to have to do the attack warning and attack assessment function of NORAD were now being no-foreign within the American structure. Well, you weren't allowed to see the propositions. It was not releasable to foreign nationals. So it was information closely held by the United States.
Right.
But in the meantime, so when we were looking at wide area surveillance systems and going there, we sometimes were excluded from the meetings of the panels and the committees that we were members of because the information was not releasable to Canada.
Yes.
So in assessing what our needs were to do the air defense role and mission, there was a conflict at times.
Yes.
Between what we could see and what they would tell us. So there was a lot of
resolution. This is very much different than earlier NORAD situation where information was free for Canadians?
Pretty well across the board, yes. There was certainly, I would think, there was some sensor information that would be unilaterally held by the United States, but by and large, the information from all of the sensors were fused in the NORAD complex at Cheyenne Mountain and provided to Strategic Air Command and the other component commanders of the United States. So.
Yes. Did you work in Cheyenne Mountain at all?
I did my turn on the... I was on the battle staff when we required... When we went to a heightened state, I would be there, yes.
Yes.
But wasn't there on a daily basis, no.
So Cheyenne Mountain was like the area where the sensing took place?
It was where the information was received, the fusion of it from all the sensors,
yes,
was received there.
Yes.
And then looked at, assessed, and distributed to the user organizations.
The region.
Yes.
Now, was Peterson Air Force Base a regional headquarters, or?
It was the head, let's call it the domestic headquarters for those, for the United, for both NORAD,
yes,
and U.S. Space Com and Air Force Space Com.
Yes.
U.S. Space Com had their sensor information that Falcon, which was another station outside that, so so the administrative functions and the planning and the command and control systems integration and all of those kinds of functions were conducted on the staff level at those headquarters,
yes,
as opposed to an operational fighting
right.
Situation. Yeah.
So there's still a fair bit of central control.
Oh, yes. Yes.
But once decisions are made for interception,
mm-hmm,
there's more of a handoff.
Yeah.
More of a handoff than there was before, I would see.
Well,
I seem to think.
Yes. In the earlier days, if I can backtrack a little
yes,
bit.
Yes, please.
There would be the command and control watching the situation and setting the aircraft up in the days of the manned bomber and the iron bomb.
Yes.
And according to the threat information you had, you would send up your fighters to what were called the stops, strategic orbital points. In other words, your fighters would be up there waiting and in position to intercept anything coming in.
Right. So they're waiting for commands.
Right.
At that point.
So those were command decisions as to when to go there, where to go there. They come out of the staff in the headquarters. Now, once it got to
that'd
level...
That would be out of Colorado Springs.
Well, no, that would
the
be the regional headquarters.
Okay.
Now, once you had done that kind of thing, you would reach a stage where you would get the word from Colorado Springs, the code words that said, we're now at war, for example. That's the ultimate. As you went through the increasing stages of readiness,
yes,
you were now at war. At that time, you would decentralize the air battle to the people in the ROC, who were the controllers on the scopes and whatever. In other words, you said, that's it. We're finished planning. You're now in charge. Do all the intercepts. It's kill. It's not identify. It's not make them unknown. It's now anything that wasn't identified is now hostile.
Right.
So you now attack. So you decentralize the air battle to the floor.
Right. But once again, this is back to the old stage system.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, when you got to the new system that we're just getting into,
yes,
it didn't quite become that easy because now you have an E3 with potentially with a squadron of F5s that's acting in a certain area, and it's the only one that can see what's going on, and you don't have that total picture back at the headquarters.
Yes.
So we're in a more fluid situation, so your command and control structure had to change quite dramatically.
Yes. Tell me about that.
I'm not sure that there's too much to add there, if I may, because there are so many variables that were ongoing.
Yes.
You may or may not have an E3 there. One of the other things for future air defense operations and the forward operation locations requirement for fighters, if there was a penetration of the North Warning System, they had to be far enough forward. So we had to plan that because you only have a detection time of knowing that, you had to have the aircraft forward deployed on readiness to scramble that aircraft within a certain time frame to be able to have a view, we call it a probability of exposure with its onboard radar,
yes,
to get an intruder.
And your target was a bomber that was carrying air-launched cruise missiles.
Yes. Okay. Now, if you didn't get there soon enough, then of course your airborne, you would not be able to detect that because they would come through the North Warning System. It could either turn left, right, go straight ahead. You wouldn't know where it was.
Yes.
Therefore, your onboard radar on an F-15 or an F-18
yes,
would not be, potentially, would not have it in its window of view.
It's more like, it has more of a directional type of radar.
But you only have a 200 nautical mile range or something in that vicinity.
Okay.
So therefore, if that aircraft had now penetrated and you weren't there for the next half hour,
yes,
he could have now transited 400 miles.
Yes.
So you have no idea where he is.
Yes.
So that is now, when you talk about the command and control and what you would do, is it depends on all of these variables now.
Mm.
So it wasn't neat and tidy to say decentralize the air battle.
Yes.
So the rules of engagement,
yes,
this is what we're talking about now, the rules of engagement would change. In other words, at a certain point, a certain moment in time, the E3 would be given the authorization to conduct autonomous operations. In other words, it would have its fighters and it would be able to make the decisions, whereas the command element back in the headquarters would not.
Yes, so the decisions would be made in the air.
There would be. As it progressed through,
yes,
changing rules of engagement, you know,
yes,
so as one would get to a full war posture, it would be free for all, everybody do what they can.
Yes.
But before that time, you want to retain still as much control because you don't wish for any escalation, if
yes,
at all possible.
Yes.
So,
or some response that's inappropriate.
That's right, yes. Or something that would trigger now... it would now trigger a massive ICBM attack.
Yes.
So,
I interviewed Brigadier General Ron Bell a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about being deputy commander up in the Alaska NORAD region I think the same time that you were in
yes,
Colorado Springs.
Yes, he was, yes.
And he talked about how he enjoyed the control of the F-15s in their intercept missions.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his pilots intercepted 10 Soviet aircraft.
Yes.
This would be, 1,000 miles or more off the American, off the Alaska
That's
coast.
Right. That's right. Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. What became really obvious during this latter transition in with the ALCM was the requirement to do what we call in the business track from origin.
Uh-huh.
In other words, one would want the sensor systems and the capability to see the Soviet LRA, the long-range aviation aircraft, lift off their runways. And that would give us time, or at least more time, to get our aircraft or our defensive posture into somewhat decent shape.
This would be satellite observation?
Both, okay.
Or intelligence?
All fused intelligence.
Yes, yes.
Whether it be satellite... could be satellite with infrared, it could be human intelligence, it could be other things. And this is where we are into all of the new technical things that were part of SDI, part of the Air Defense Initiative, part of the Strategic Defense 2000 initiatives. All of these kinds of things that were on the drawing board and in research and development.
Yes.
Driving that requirement for track from origin.
Yes. So. Brigadier General Bell talked about how much on these exercises that the Soviets carried out, they had intelligence of their operations very early in the process.
Yes.
Which is exactly what you're talking about.
Yes, yes indeed. Yes. Uh-huh. And in fact, you know, while things have changed quite dramatically now, up to this present day, Soviet Union, in the last few months, were flying bear missions again in the Arctic.
Not just in Europe. They're testing in the Arctic, defense in the
same similar thing that they did before. The bear is perhaps not totally dead.
Yes.
The threat has dramatically changed. It's going away. But they still flex their muscles just a little bit.
I'll just pause here for a bit.
Sure.
To finish off the interview, Colonel Reed, I'd like to talk about information I recently discovered looking at NORAD's homepage. NORAD's now defined in terms of three regions, Alaska, Canada, and the contiguous United States. Now, the United States Command is based out of Florida. I think it's called Tyndale?
No. In Florida, it's Tyndall Air Force.
Tyndall Air Force Base,
yes.
And the Canadian Command is out of Winnipeg.
Okay.
And I believe Alaska is out of Elmendorf.
Yes. Okay.
The Cheyenne Mountain Complex has been, it's not used on a daily basis. It's been sort of treated as an emergency command center. And NORAD is based out of Peterson, and also the NORTHCOM command, I believe.
Okay. Well, I'm not too terribly familiar with that. Northern Command was, I believe, was formed as their interior command structure of the United States.
Yes.
I'm surprised that. That Cheyenne Mountain is not used on a daily basis, because at Peterson Air Force Base, unless there's been dramatic change there, the information, the fusion of all the information and the sensor information, it was going into Cheyenne Mountain. It wasn't going into the domestic unit, as I recall it, at Peterson.
Oh.
So that surprises me.
Right. In fact, you think with your recent Soviet postures in the Arctic you mentioned earlier,
yes,
that Cheyenne Mountain should be on alert.
Well, not necessarily so. If I would speculate just for a moment, as I understand it, the over-the-horizon backscatter radars were never put in place. We have lost our coastal radars, and we still have a north warning system. There are no fighter aircraft sitting on alert, to my knowledge now, like we did have before. They didn't follow through with the forward operating locations for fighters and building them and exercising out of them. So what does that mean in terms of NORAD? It would imply to me that essentially NORAD is non-operational in that sense. However, there is a transition here. There's been a resurgence of at least one of my hobby horses that Canada needed to do more about its sovereignty, yes, sovereignty mission.
Yes.
So we still need to have some control, or at least some information about anything that's coming through our periphery, our borders. In the north, that means that we would still wish to know if something is coming through the north warning system. However, on the west and east coast, there is no raw radar, as I call it, raw radar capability. So anything that was transiting or coming in there, even from a sovereignty point of view, we can't see them. So, and sovereignty and a NORAD mission essentially, to a degree, went hand in hand.
Yes.
If we had the coastal radars, we would still be able to do the sovereignty mission if anybody's coming in, although there is no apparent threat there. So our capability has certainly gone down. But also the threat has dramatically changed.
Yes.
So if there is no threat in that sense, then perhaps there is no need for a full-up NORAD system anymore. But there's still, certainly from a sovereignty point of view, one would wish to control access for a myriad of reasons. So.
Yes. I mean, recently, I think in August, Prime Minister Harper made the announcement about increasing the operations at Resolute Bay from the Navy and Army point of view.
Yes.
And I imagine Resolute Bay has always been Air Force capable.
Well, not very much at Resolute Bay.
No.
Not from
it couldn't be that point of view. Forward base?
We didn't consider Resolute as one of the forward bases at that time.
Ah, okay.
The forward operating location would have been Inuvik, Whitehorse, probably Rankin Inlet,
Churchill?
And Iqaluit, yes.
Yes.
So those were the four that we were looking at that time for the forward operating locations.
They sound very familiar to some of the Avro plant for their bases for Avro Aero.
Oh, okay.
Looking at some of the charts that I looked up in the Avro books.
Oh.
They talked about, they showed various forward operating locations based on a 600 nautical mile radius of operation.
Right.
And they showed the overlapping coverage of what an Avro Aero could do.
Oh, okay.
So in terms of sovereignty,
yes,
I see very similar concepts in the 50s from a sovereignty point of view to what you're discussing now.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I've been an advocate of the requirement for us to have more forces in that sovereignty role with the limited number of forces that we have now. I think that, you know, we abandoned in large measure the Arctic patrols with our long-range patrol aircraft. And, you know, those should certainly be, reinforced. The same as the watch on our coasts and having the resources to do that. I think it's a very important mission, the sovereignty of Canada.
Yes, in 1959, 20th of February, that's the date that the Avro Aero project was officially cancelled by the Diefenbaker government.
Mm-hmm.
Doing some reading on it, it would appear that the Liberal government was anticipating that cancellation as well. But considering the planning done by the RCAF and the U.S. Air Force, it strikes me that the cancellation of the Avro Aero required a radical change in planning. Do you feel that was so, or any comments on that idea?
I'm not sure that the Aero, or the cancellation of the Aero, would have driven a dramatic change of plans as such. It would have been, if all of its promise had come true, it would have given us a lot more punch, a lot more depth. It would have been a great asset. But at that time, I don't think it would have materially changed the requirement against the Soviet long-range aviation. And when one thinks of the requirement for the ground radars, the Mid-Canada line, the Pine Tree line, and those particular things, it would have been a marvelous asset.
Yes. One of the cost problems I understand from reading some of the literature was that the RCAF wanted a control system that would operate within SAGE and outside of SAGE, and that became a very complicated design problem for Hughes or RCA to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
But the Aero would have become a long-range interceptor that could operate outside of SAGE. as opposed to, let's say, a weapon like the voodoo, which I believe was confined by Sage.
Well, okay. The voodoo was not, in a sense, confined by Sage.
Okay.
It was Sage capable
okay.
of the data link and the control and intercept from the ground.
Right.
But it was also not constrained in that sense, because if it got voice commands of where its target was,
yeah.
then the pilot would fly it there and intercept it eventually with his own fire control radars.
Right.
At the time, I think, with the Arrow, the promise was that it was going to have a much more sophisticated radar suite. It would also, at that time, they were playing back and forth with the Arrow as to what its air-to-air missile might be. There were
yes.
two or three different candidates
there.
The
Falcon, the Sparrow.
Yeah. So if you have an increased fire control system or a better fire control system, you have a better air-to-air missile, then, of course, you have enhanced that whole thing. And sure, it would do it, but I don't think it would fundamentally have changed the planning of that. It would have certainly been potentially much more versatile, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the conundrum was, and I believe you and I discussed that with the book, it was essentially decided that that you could either have the Arrow or the Bowmarks, but not both. And if that was the choice and the decision, so be it. And that
Sage
was,
comes into that story as well. The Bowmark was a Sage-controlled weapon, I believe.
Integrated into the system, yes.
Yes, yeah. So the cost of all three was too much for Canada to afford at that time.
I'm not sure of that aspect. I'll have to leave that one to you for your research.
I think that'll be enough. We can end our interview here. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, you're welcome.